All right, everyone, House Energy will come to order. Ms. Blair, will you please take the roll?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bishop?
Here.
Representative Brewster?
Here.
Representative Fielder?
Here.
Vice Chair Galloway?
Present.
Representative Green?
Excused.
Representative Harvey?
Here.
Representative Kazmaier?
Here.
Representative Kmetz?
Here.
Representative Knudsen?
Excused.
Representative Cordham?
Here.
Representative Phelan?
Here.
Vice Chair Sullivan?
Here.
Chair Zolnikov?
Here.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, everyone, we have a quorum and we are ready to do business. We are going to switch up our agenda a little bit today and do executive action first, and then we will move into our bill hearings. This is just to accommodate some crazy schedules. So we will now open executive action. Today we will be doing House Bill 394 and 395. So let's open on House Bill 394. Vice Chair Galloway.
Madam Chair, move that we move House Bill 394 and do pass.
Thank you, Vice Chair Galloway. Mr. Graff, would you like to give a quick overview of that bill for the committee's memory?
Madam Chair, committee members, House Bill 394 revises laws related to the education of American Indian children, establishing a collaborative exploration of the creation of state tribal education accord schools. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Graff. Is there discussion on the bill? Discussion on the bill. Okay. Question has been called. I think we'll do a roll call vote on that one. So all in favor of House Bill 394 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, nay. Okay, no opposed. Proxies?
Madam Chair, Casey Knutson votes aye by proxy.
Vice Chair Galloway?
Paul Green votes aye by proxy.
Thank you, Vice Chair Galloway.
Larry Brewster votes aye by proxy.
All right, it appears that the motion was unanimous and it will move to the floor. This concludes executive action on House Bill 394. Now we will open executive action on House Bill 395. Trevor, if you could give, Vice Chair Galloway.
Madam Chair, we do move that House Bill 395 be considered to and be voted to pass, do pass.
Thank you, Vice Chair Galloway. Mr. Graff, if you could give us a quick overview.
Madam Chair, committee members, House Bill 395 provides for an opportunity for tribal consultation in education. It also requires school districts serving significant numbers of American Indian children to consult with tribes. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Graff. Is there discussion on the motion? Vice Chair Sullivan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move to the amendment, House Bill, HB 395 001001, and do pass, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Sullivan. Would you like to speak on the amendment, or would you like Mr. Graff?
I can. I know this amendment is friendly to the sponsor, and the main portion being on page 1, line 21, it is struck, the tribal government may decline consultation, so that would be removed. Therefore, in the process, the tribal government could not decline, meaning that they would need to participate fully with the process that is described in the consultation process, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Sullivan. Is there discussion on the amendment? Question has been called. I think we can probably just do a voice vote on this amendment. Any objections? Okay, we will do a voice vote. All in favor of amendment 395.1.1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Proxies?
Madam Chair, have Larry Brewster, aye by proxy, Paul Green, aye by proxy, and Casey Knutson, aye by proxy.
Thank you, Vice Chair Galloway. It looks like the amendment was unanimous. Is there discussion on the bill as once amended? Vice Chair Galloway, could you please move the bill?
Madam Chair, do motion to move House Bill 395 as once amended and do pass.
All right. Now we have a motion. So is there discussion on the bill as amended? Vice Chair Sullivan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will be supporting this bill because it's just encouraging a consultation between the schools and the tribes in sections of Montana where the population of students is over 50%, and that seems like a good idea in terms of getting these kids to have the best education that they can have, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Sullivan. Further discussion on the bill as amended? Representative Kastmeyer.
Madam Chair, I'm substitute motion to table House Bill 395.
You've heard the motion by Representative Kastmeyer. This is a non-debatable motion, and we will do a roll call vote on this one. Please, Ms. Blair.
Representative Bishop?
No.
Representative Brewster?
Yes, by proxy.
Representative Fielder?
Yes.
Vice Chair Galloway?
Yes.
Representative Green?
No, by proxy.
Representative Harvey?
No.
Representative Kastmeyer?
Yes.
Representative Kmetz?
Yes.
Representative Knutson?
No, by proxy.
Representative Cordham?
No.
Representative Phelan?
Yes.
Vice Chair Sullivan?
No.
Chair Zolnikoff?
Yes. Members, it looks like the motion carried with a vote of 7-6. So this will go back in our folders and will be on the table. This concludes executive action on House Bill 395. Okay, that's our EA for today. So we do have two bills that we will be hearing. One is HJ6 and one is HB558. We will go ahead and start with HJ6. So we will just give a brief moment while we switch out the committee chairs and I make my way to the podium.
Committee, we will now be in order, and Representative Zolnikoff, are you prepared to present your bill? And we'll open the hearing on House Joint Resolution 6.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the House Energy Committee. I'm Katie Zolnikoff. I represent House District 45 out of Billings. And today, I bring before you House Joint Resolution 6. And to answer your question, Mr. Chair, I am just about prepared. For some reason, this is not pulling up. So give me just 1 second. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Joint Resolution 6 is a, this was brought to me by Montana's Electric Co-ops, and they brought to me this bill. They want to, it's a request to study in the interim committee and investigate the causes of a situation that nearly led to rolling blackouts in Montana in February of 2021, and that very well could happen again if preventative measures are not taken. I won't take too long on this because the proponents will describe how the ever decreasing availability of baseload electric generation and an increased demand and a lack of options available to the balancing authority nearly led to blackouts for Montana's electric co-ops and industries. So this resolution is an interim study for the legislature to determine what caused the situation and to develop a number of options the balancing authority, utilities, and wholesale transmission customers can deploy to prevent it from reoccurring. So the idea with this bill is instead of passing policies this session that, you know, forces either a utility or a wholesaler or a co-op or a large user to abide by new laws and regulations, we take a very comprehensive look at this and identify ways where everybody can sort of pitch in to help solve this problem. So at my request, the proponents worked with the representative of Montana's large industrial customers to try to reach a consensus on this interim study. One of the requests of these customers was providing the option for load curtailment. However, I didn't really feel like this was necessary for this study that we're looking at right here. I don't know if they will be in today in opposition, but I did just want to add that in my testimony that that was part of their request, and I just didn't see it fitting in what I was hoping to accomplish with this study. So thank you, committee, for hearing this. And we have some great people that are going to speak on this today, and I'm happy to answer questions about this or my intentions. And with that, I'll open it up to everybody. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Zonikoff. We'll open the hearing up for proponents in the room.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Mark Lambrecht, LAMBRECHT, on behalf of the Montana Electric Cooperatives Association. So the resolution before you references an extreme cold weather event in February 2021, as the sponsor mentioned, in which delivery of electricity supply to a wholesale customer of an investor-owned utility was interrupted, and the utility was nearly unable to meet its electricity delivery obligations to some of its customers, including electric cooperatives, and nearly caused rolling blackouts in Montana. This situation was nearly repeated at the end of December last year. Montana's electric cooperatives brought this resolution to the legislature to request an interim study to investigate the causes of these situations and determine how to prevent them from reoccurring. But first, I'd like to talk to you about how the grid is managed. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, establishes reliability standards for the grid, which are enforced by the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, or NERC, and delegated to regional entities such as the Western Electricity Coordinating Council, or WECC. So balancing authorities such as Northwestern Energy are responsible for balancing electricity supply and demand on their electric systems in real time within the WECC. Other balancing authorities operating in Montana include the Bonneville Power Administration, the Western Area Power Administration, the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator, and the Southwest Power Pool. Balancing authorities require sufficient electricity generation flows into the transmission system to meet load or demand. If the load changes, generation must be ramped up or down to maintain balance. Wholesale customers or suppliers in the balancing authority must tell the transmission operator the day before what their expected loads and generation supply will be, so the balancing authority can match total generation with total demand. The balancing authority constantly monitors the situation and can make small changes within seconds throughout the day and night. And balancing authorities have this responsibility under the following FERC requirements. First, Schedule 3, which provides for continuous balance of resources, including generation with load, and is accomplished by committing online generation that is raised or lowered through automatic generating control equipment. This provision is intended to handle normal variations, though, not loss of generation. Second, Schedule 4 requires purchase of energy imbalance service when a difference occurs between the scheduled and actual delivery of energy to a load. So each transmission provider and customers must retain the services of a market operator to procure the least cost energy to resolve energy imbalances in real time. Third, Schedule 5 requires synchronized supplemental reserve services to immediately serve load in the event of a system contingency. These are operating reserves and spending reserves capable of being quickly dispatched into the transmission system to balance generation with load. So spending reserves include generation capacity that is running but has additional capacity that can be ramped up within a 10-minute period. Typical sources of spending reserves are hydropower, natural gas, or even coal plants that are providing energy, but a portion of their capacity has additional unused capacity that needs to be synchronized into the system. Non-spinning reserves are units that are not synchronized to the frequency of the system but can be available within 10 minutes of notification. While non-spinning reserves have the same 10-minute requirement as spinning reserves, these units take longer to begin to contributing partial generating capacity since they must be first synchronized. So curtailed demand can also provide non-spinning reserves, provided it is capable of receiving dispatch instruction and can be ramped down within 10 minutes. Both spinning and non-spinning reserves are needed to maintain grid reliability. Especially with increasing sources of wind and solar power in the system, which increases the need for balancing reserves to take care of minute-by-minute and hour-to-hour variability. So the problem we faced in February 2021 happened when generation scheduled into the balancing authority didn't make it into the system. This occurred because extreme weather events in parts of the region made some generation unavailable to serve all the demand in Montana. Compounding the problem was the fact that FERC regulations do not provide for replacement power if pledged generation doesn't arrive. The balancing authority wasn't immediately aware which scheduled power didn't arrive because there are multiple deliveries from multiple generation sources across the transmission path. In order to prevent blackouts, the balancing authority had to quickly secure alternate generation from other sources, but little was available. The balancing authority was only able to prevent blackouts in Montana because it quickly pivoted and secured every bit of generation available. However, the balancing authority was within 30 minutes of having to curtail Montana load, including its retail customers, electric cooperatives, and others, had it not been successful in its last-minute efforts. Load curtailment would have been required, resulting in blackouts during freezing weather, a tremendously dangerous situation no one wants to face. So the balancing authority has no way of knowing which generation didn't arrive until after the fact. That's a really important part of this. This never used to be a problem in Montana when the state had more than sufficient baseload generation for use within the balancing authority. However, there's been a significant increase in electricity demand in Montana in recent years, and baseload generation development has not kept pace. In fact, an ongoing study at the University of Montana Bureau of Business and Research indicates that Montana, within the next 5 to 10 years, will be a net importer of electricity rather than a net exporter. Other balancing authorities in the region have recognized the same problem and are considering forming a pool with shared power reserves to prevent disruption. And this resolution is needed to establish an interim study so the Montana legislature, balancing authorities, industries, and electric cooperatives can better understand this situation and develop specific options to prevent disruptions. The sponsor requested the resolution focus the interim study on this specific issue and solutions targeted to address it rather than a larger electric grid study, which was accomplished by the interim committee last year. With that in mind, we asked the legislature to evaluate potential options available to a balancing authority, including the following. Number one, requiring pledges of electricity supply reserves above peak demand a balancing authority can summon to manage loads during critical periods. Two, determine whether to require utilities and wholesale electric generation suppliers to participate in a pool for electric power generation reserves. Three, determine when electric power reserves should be made available to the balancing authority to prevent disruptions. And last, examine the feasibility of providing wholesale transmission customers the option of curtailing their load either in part or in full instead of contracting for additional electric reserves. In closing, I'd say Montana's electric cooperatives would like to recognize the sponsor for bringing this resolution forward and thank the committee for its attention to this very important issue. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Hayden, last name spelled H-A-Y-D-E-N. I'm the general manager of Missoula Electric Cooperative. We serve over 16,000 meters in western Montana and eastern Idaho, and I'm here today to urge your support for House Joint Resolution 6. Missoula Electric Cooperative is an all-requirements customer of Bonneville Power, and I won't go into the details. The previous speaker did a great job of talking about spinning reserves and supplemental reserves, and I can tell you that each month on our power bill, we pay a portion that goes towards spinning and supplemental reserves. Last month, it was roughly $20,000. We're also transfer customers of Northwestern Energy, which means our loads are in their balancing authority. I won't repeat the earlier testimony, except to say that the threat of reliability is real. The bill speaks to events back in 2021, but fast forward to 2022. In the spring, Northwestern Energy, our BA, asked us to prioritize our critical and non-critical loads in the event curtailment was necessary. Now, as you can imagine, these curtailments aren't going to, or generally aren't going to happen on a nice 70-degree spring day. It's going to be in the depths of cold or other extreme weather events. And this planning was prudent. I mean, we need to plan for these things. They could occur at any time, but it underscores the need for this study. MEC's ratepayers are investing each month in reserves to buffer the impacts of this variation in generation. But not everyone is. And how am I to prioritize loads for shutoffs, especially that member at the end of the line when it's 30 below out, and I'm telling them that I've prioritized them first for shutoff in the event that these things happen. This study would not necessarily prevent the need for curtailment in the future, but it would seek a level playing field when these important decisions must be made by our balancing authority. Please support House Joint Resolution 6, and thank you for the opportunity to comment today. I'll be available to answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Patrick Powers, last name spelled P-O-W-E-R-S, and I serve as the Director of Grid Real-Time and SCADA Operations for Northwestern Energy. The Grid Ops Group is responsible for the operation of the balancing authority and the transmission system in Montana. Northwestern Energy rises in solid support of HJ6, and we appreciate the work of the sponsor and the Montana Electric Co-ops for bringing forth the topic of resource adequacy to the forefront. Resource adequacy is of growing importance to Northwestern Energy, given our responsibility as a balancing authority and a transmission operator, and the continued peak demand coupled with reduction of capacity and resources to meet that demand at critical hours. As a balancing authority, Northwestern Energy is responsible to balance supply and demand on a continual real-time basis. And as a transmission operator, we're responsible for the local transmission system as part of the grid. Balancing authority tasks are challenging because not all of our customers are source supply customers of Northwestern Energy. These include electric co-ops and large industrial customers who get their supply from wholesale suppliers. Regardless of multiple suppliers, Northwestern Energy is still responsible to deliver and balance supply and demand to all customers under the FERC open access transmission tariff. Northwestern Energy has a responsibility as a public utility to plan for future needs and reserves, including adequate power resources. However, some third-party wholesale electric transmission customers do not have that same clear responsibility. The discrepancy did not seem to be a significant problem in the past. However, in recent years, the decline in regional generation combined with the growth of energy demands has raised concerns related to third party and overall resource adequacy. Let me give you an example. During Christmas week in December of 2022, Northwestern Energy hit a new balancing authority peak load of 2,073 megawatts, Of that, 1,200 megawatts were being served by our supply internal to Northwestern Energy. That means roughly 42% of that peak demand was being served by wholesale suppliers over which Northwestern Energy has no control. Even if a fraction of those suppliers failed to meet delivery obligations, we very well could have faced a grid emergency. During a grid emergency, federal regulations require Northwestern Energy to treat all transmission customers equally by issuing curtailments on a pro rata basis. Therefore, it doesn't matter if your energy provider shows up. We may need to curtail your power if someone else's provider fails to meet its obligations. HJ 6 directs the legislator to study whether third-party wholesale electric transmission customers should be subject to similar resource adequacy requirements as Northwestern Energy or any other utility. In doing so, it has the potential to promote fairness among all customers who depend on the grid while increasing stability and reliability of our power system as a whole. For those reasons, Northwestern urges a due pass. Thank you, and I'm available if the committee has any follow-up questions.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Doug Hardy, testifying on behalf of the Montana Electric Cooperatives Association. My real job is I run a power supply cooperative. I supply to about a third of the co-ops in the state, and much of the power we supply, even though we have our own generation sources, is wheeled across Northwestern Energy's transmission system, wrapping back to the point that we can have all of our supply there, and yet we can still have loads curtailed. If what you heard about that would be part of the study, just minimally, are types of reserves that people are paying for. We, as a wholesale customer, pay for it. Northwestern provides regulating. They may have their own generation do it. They may contract with other generation. They also are in an energy imbalance market. But you think about regulation, up and down, like 4 seconds to adjust. Energy imbalance, like 5-minute changes. But there's a limit to energy imbalance. There's only so much power out there. If you can get more in that energy imbalance, power stays on as they were looking for more. The other type thing that will be the primary focus of this is what some areas we call planning reserves. I hate to put a title on it. There's not a title in the bill, and that's good because you can box yourself in on what the reserves are or how you get them. There's no predetermined solution. There's solutions that are out there, but we don't know that they'll be best for Montana. That's how come it's really important to us that we have an interim legislative committee come up to speed on it. With FERC leaving this bigger question on the large load loss type, how to have the generation up to states, if they're not in the market, that's where it comes to play. If you look at like SPP that serves in the eastern part, you would have your peak loads, plus you'd also commit another 12%. You had to have it of accredited loads. That means loads that can actually be there when you need them. So you'd have to have peak plus 12%. They recently increased that to 15%. So you may have 4,000 megawatts of load, but you're going to have maybe 7,000 megawatts to serve that because some of it's going to be intermittent. But it has to be there. So this study is different than resource adequacy in general. There's another bill that will talk about resource adequacy and potentially have a select committee on it, if I read it right. This is about purely that reserve level that goes and how do we make sure that there's enough reserves to the BA that they can be called on. We share maybe in a regional area to where this could be a multi-state, and there's all the generation from all the different places. When somebody goes down, somebody else is there, and we actually keep the power on. We can gold plate our distribution systems, make them almost bulletproof. Not that they are, but we could do that, and that costs a lot of money, but it doesn't do any good if your distribution system never has an outage if your power supply doesn't get there. It's a big issue. I think the ones that are on the committee in the interim will find this something that can actually have an executable outcome that will have a result that will be good for Montana. Thank you very much. I'm available for questions.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robin Arnold, ARNOLD. I'm the Markets and Transmission Director for Renewable Northwest, and we also support this bill. Unlike some of the co-ops that spoke earlier, we may disagree on the causes of reliability issues in the region. We do not believe it's because of declining baseload power. However, we do believe that reliability is a very important issue that this committee should be studying. We've been very strong supporters of the Western Resource Adequacy Program, which has developed in the region, and Northwestern Energy recently committed to joining that program. And MDU is already in a different resource adequacy program through MISO, the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator, which has its own resource adequacy standards as well as a planning reserve margin. We believe a lot of the resource adequacy issues are being caused by aging transmission infrastructure. A lot of transmission in this region is 25 to 50 years old, and there is very little available transmission capacity left in the region. So we believe it is a very important topic for this study, this committee to look at, as well as our alternatives such as demand response. There's been talk about load curtailment. If there is a program in place to adequately compensate customers for that load curtailment, oftentimes it can avoid emergency situations. We saw this most recently in California. In September, they were dangerously close to having severe blackouts. However, they called upon demand response through emergency measures, and they were able to avoid those blackouts. So again, we support this bill and urge it to pass. Thank you.
Any more proponents in the room?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chris Puyer, P as in Paul, U-Y-E-A-R. Also here on behalf of Northwestern Energy, I won't repeat any of the testimony, but I do track the regional conversations around resource adequacy fairly closely, and I'm available for questions.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amy Grimalis. It's G-R-M-O-L-J-E-Z. I represent MDU Resources, and we just wanted to echo our support for the bill. Thank you.
Any other proponents in the room? Not seeing any proponents online?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we'll go to opponents in the room. Any opponents in the room? Seeing none, any opponents online?
No, Mr. Chair.
Any informational witnesses in the room? Seeing none, any informational witnesses online?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we'll go to questions from the committee. Representative Kmetz.
Mr. Chair, a question for Mr. Lambert.
Mr. Lambert.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kmetz.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lambert, why don't we just turn Colstrip 1 and 2 back on? Problem solved.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kmetz, that's a decision beyond our purview. Certainly, that was important baseload generation in the system here, but just leave it at that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I just thought I would mention that. Thank you.
Any other questions, committee? Representative Phelan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Lambert.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Phelan.
Mr. Lambert, or Mr. Chair, Mr. Lambert, I do echo Representative Kmetz's thought there, but I believe I heard a couple of times in your testimony that you said there was no rolling blackouts in 21. Or no blackouts in 21. Did I hear you correctly or not?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Phelan, from my recollection, there were disruptions at that time, but not to the degree of being considered rolling blackouts.
Follow up?
Yes.
Follow up.
Would you explain a rolling blackout then, please?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Phelan, if I could defer this question over to Mr. Hardy, he's an expert on those types of things. If, with permission,
Mr. Hardy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Phelan, there were rolling blackouts in eastern Montana and part of SPP, and there were throughout from North Texas to Canada, and a lot of reasons for that. But yes, those rolling blackouts were over there. And a curtailment and a rolling blackout to me is the same thing. We're out of power either way. A blackout to some people means the whole area is just out of power. And a rolling curtailments will be, okay, you're off for 1 hour, you're back on. You're off for an hour, you're back on. And they'll do it that way if that can meet the load. If it's too big of a gap in large areas. And the whole idea is if you didn't have people in Butte, such as Patrick, taking care of that, and they didn't do something, everything would trip out, and you'd have the classic blackout, like New England, completely black. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is one thing I was going to say, is because my wife said we were out for 2 hours in 21. So anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cordham.
Mr. Chair, for Mr. Powers, please.
For Mr. Powers.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cordham.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Powers, during the event in 21, were there any large crypto operations online, and did that contribute to the load?
Yes, there were.
Follow-up?
Follow-up? The total balancing authority load, yes.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair, Mr. Powers, did you have a guess at the percentage of the load that was?
In 2021, I think that percentage would have probably been about 80 megawatts of the total 1,970, I think, was the peak at that time.
Thank you, Mr. Powers. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions, committee? Seeing no other questions, I will comment on what Representative Phelan said. I don't live over on the eastern part. I live in Sun Prairie area, and we were out of power 27 hours last year. It kind of gets your attention. Kind of gets cold when the furnace won't come on, and much longer it would have gotten to be an issue. So definitely, I don't think it's an isolated incident for those of us in the rural area. So Representative, would you like to close on your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for a great hearing. I am not a person that always supports study bills. Sometimes I think that they are a mechanism that the legislature uses to just avoid making some difficult decisions on policy. However, I don't think that this is one of those studies. As you all know, by serving on this committee, the energy sector is complicated. There are moving pieces that are changing rapidly, and there are a lot of people that are stakeholders that are involved in this. So it's my hope with this study that we can bring all of the key players to the table to have a thorough and honest look at our energy market in Montana. And I think that this is imperative not only for us as a legislature, but for our entire state. As I don't think I have to remind anyone that these are very important topics that we're talking about. I do think that this study covers a wide variety of topics that I am excited to learn more about should it pass. And this distinguishes it, as you heard in testimony, from the study on resource adequacy that we heard last week in this committee. This bill is supported by our utilities and by our co-ops, and I'm just hoping that we can pass this bill and we can facilitate a collaborative conversation on this very important topic, and we can come back to the legislature potentially next time with some good policy ideas versus kind of stabbing into the dark now and hoping that, you know, these people over here don't oppose and these people over here are good with it. So with that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I ask for a due pass on HJ6. Thank you.
And committee, thank you, Representative Zolnikoff, and that closes the hearing on HJ6. Committee, be at ease while we make a couple changes.
righty. Where am I at? We will now hear House Bill 558. Representative Galloway, would you like to open on your bill? There it is.
Madam Chairman and good Energy Committee, I am Representative Stephen Galloway. I have the pleasure of serving in House District 24, and I do feel it a privilege to have been elected to serve. Today, I bring you a bill that isn't real complicated, but I felt that we needed to get this on the books. So, to clarify, Montana Public Service Commission contested cases for regulatory proceedings. This bill makes it a simple change to ensure that the commission has the authority. I'll repeat that, the commission has the authority, which is what we created the PSC to do, to determine how it accepts evidence into cases involving regulatory utilities. The commission is a quasi-judicial body, and it's important for them to control their own process to ensure efficient operation of their agency. That's all this bill does. And I will sit for proponents and opponents and reserve the right to close.
Now we will hear proponents.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, one more time for the record, my name is Chris Puyer, P as in Paul, U-Y-E-A-R, here on behalf of Northwestern Energy. Northwestern Energy supports House Bill 558. This bill really makes a small tweak in the law regarding PSC depositions. And what we're intending to do here is to align the law with what's already in administrative rule and is current practice for the Public Service Commission. And namely, that's that the PSC has the sole discretion to determine when depositions are appropriate in regulatory proceedings. Now, full disclosure, I'm not a lawyer, but I think it might be helpful to take a step back and look at some of the differences between how the PSC functions and how a regular court functions to understand why this change is important. So in a civil proceeding, you start with a real bare bones complaint. And this is kind of a bare bones document. And the role of discovery, the role of depositions, is to build record evidence and learn the details of the case. So you start out with not a lot of information, and you're engaging in fact finding. In contrast, in a PSC proceeding, you start with an application and a pre-filed testimony that's this thick. There's tons of information, there's tons of evidence that are presented up front, and then the parties have an opportunity to flush out that case through written data requests. And these are questions that parties get to ask of one another regarding the details of the pre-filed testimony. So to give you an example of the magnitude of this process, in Northwestern's ongoing rate case, we answered 2,000 individual data requests. So 2,000 different pieces of information, and that information was supplied by 27 witnesses. Now imagine that instead of getting to do that process through written data requests, every one of those 27 witnesses was deposed. So you have to schedule a time, you have to get everyone scheduled on the same page, you prepare, and then you go through the deposition process. It would take, rate cases today already take 360 days. It would take multiple years to get through a rate case under this paradigm. And so the problem that we're trying to fix in existing law is right now under the statute, any party to the proceeding has a right to compel the deposition of another party. So it's not up to the commission, it's up to the parties whether or not they initiate in a deposition. And as a result, these depositions are often being used as a delay tactic to gunk up the process, or in some cases to intimidate witnesses. And so what House Bill 558 simply does is it restores the commission's authority to determine whether or not to allow depositions in proceedings. If the deposition is warranted and the commission agrees, they can allow it to go forward. But if the other party is on a fishing expedition, or for some reason the commission finds it's not appropriate, under this bill they would have the authority to deny that deposition and ask the party to ask their questions through the standard written data request process. So that's all the bill does, and I urge you to pass.
Thank you. Next proponent. No more proponents in the room? Any proponents online?
No, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Opponents now.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ian Lund, spelled L-U-N-D, and I'm here on behalf of the Montana Environmental Information Center. My understanding of the bill is not quite as one of the proponents just described it. Under the way the bill is written, it seems like only the commission will be able to bring depositions or to depose anyone, and the parties will not be allowed to. Currently in the rate case, there has been one deposition of one Northwestern employee. That was the Vice President of Regulatory Affairs. And the reason there was a deposition is because a number of the parties had specific questions about a novel and unusual rate or cost recovery mechanism that Northwestern Energy was proposing in its rate case. And the parties felt that they were not getting the adequate information from data requests. And so it went to the commission and it asked if it could do a deposition. And the commission deliberated and it decided, because this is an unusual mechanism, because it might be helpful to hear from the regulatory affairs, like, let's allow this deposition. And the PSC authorized the deposition after sort of doing a bit of a vetting process and deciding whether or not to approve it. It could have denied it, and it chose not to. And so I just want to sort of clear up the record that the depositions are not being used in rate. They're a rare thing to be used in a rate case. They're not being used to intimidate witnesses or gunk up the process. They're being used to actually answer important questions that interested parties have in contested proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you. Next opponent. No additional opponents in the room. Any online?
No, Madam Chair.
All right. Any informational witnesses in the room?
Good morning, members of the committee. Madam Chair, Lucas Hamilton, H-A-M-I-L-T-O-N, from the Montana Public Service Commission. Happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Any more informational witness in the room? Any online?
No, Madam Chair.
All right. Questions from the committee? Representative Kmetz.
Madam Chair, I have a question for Mr. Hamilton.
Mr. Hamilton.
Madam Chair, Representative.
Madam Chair, Mr. Hamilton, if I vote yes for this, will it speed up the process?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know that it would materially change the process. The deadlines that the commission operates on are set by statute. So we try to adhere by those in every case. So we'll always be shooting for completing a case within the timeline provided by statute.
Question?
Follow up.
How does this work? Can you just explain it to me? I just am not quite getting the nuts and bolts of this. Maybe how it's working now and how it will work later. Maybe could you just talk through that a little bit?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd be happy to. So right now, the commission does have a rule, an administrative rule, that defines when a party can conduct a deposition. As a general rule in commission proceedings, as you heard from other witnesses on this bill, written depositions or written questions of witnesses are the far more common way of gathering information. So unlike a civil case, in a commission proceeding, we do have voluminous pre-filed written testimony. You know what the witness is going to say before the witness ever takes the stand. So you don't really need to go through quite the same mode of civil investigation and discovery that you would see in a traditional civil case. As a result, most proceedings in front of the commission can be completed with only written questions to the witnesses. But if the circumstances require, the commission's rule does allow parties to ask for additional methods of discovery, including a deposition. So the current Northwestern rate case is a good example. It's, to my knowledge, the only recent example where somebody actually went through the process, but you can ask the commission for approval to conduct a deposition. The commission will deliberate. And if the commission believes that the circumstances justify it, the commission will grant leave to conduct a deposition.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? I have a question for Mr. Hamilton. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hamilton. My question is, I'm hearing the words restore. So we're going to restore authority or restore commission's authority. I'm curious about the history of this section of code, deposition of witnesses, and that if, you know, was it, how long have we been able to have the commission or any party to the proceeding, and is this something that was just recently granted?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is a very old section of statute. It predates the modern rules of civil procedure, which is where we find depositions, at least in their modern sense. So the statute in front of you discusses conducting depositions in a, and I'm going to paraphrase here because I don't have the statute in front of me, but in a like manner to civil depositions. So in the modern day, that means we're referring to the rules of civil procedure, which technically didn't exist at the time this statute was first codified. So it is a very old statute. I would note, though, that this is still a very rarely used section of Title 69. We rarely see parties requesting that the commission grant leave for a deposition. I would also note that because the statute says a deposition in a like manner as civil procedure or in a civil litigation, the commission has construed that to mean that the commission, in that sense, has every authority that a district court would have in civil litigation. And that includes the authority to limit the number and scope of depositions. So effectively what the commission has done through its rules is reduced the normal civil standard, which is you get to conduct 10 depositions without leave of court, down to zero. You're going to ask the commission in the very first instance for leave to conduct a deposition. And the commission's interpretation is based on Rule 26 of the Rules of Civil Procedure, which allows courts to limit the frequency and number of depositions that may be taken.
Thank you. And another question is, in terms of the comment you just made that says that the PSC can reduce or limit the amounts and you're able to kind of oversee that process, are you seeing an amount of depositions become abusive? Is there, I mean, I feel like you were saying there was a low number of depositions, but I'm also feeling like I'm hearing there might be a high number that become a burden. Can you comment on that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I can say that we've had one case since I've been with the commission, which is all of 2.5 years, where a party actually sought leave from the commission in order to conduct a deposition. We have had cases, however, in that same time period where the parties stipulated to depositions, where there was no other method of gathering the information, so they just agreed to conduct depositions without ever bringing it in front of the commission. And that is, of course, acceptable. So it isn't a high frequency, but I would say that it does depend on the case, because we have various statutory deadlines to operate under. In Class D motor carrier cases, garbage haulers, for example, from the date that a protest is received, we have to schedule a hearing within 60 days. And that is a very quick turnaround for any party to schedule and conduct extensive discovery, including depositions. So in those cases, if parties were to request a high volume of depositions, or potentially even one very long deposition, we could be in a position of having to reorient procedural schedules and potentially not meet that deadline, a statutory deadline.
Thank you. I'm going to let the other members ask more questions before I do. Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? No? Okay, one more question. I'm sorry, Mr. Hamilton, and I'll let you go. My final question is if this is depositions of witnesses is removed, so it's the commission only rather than any party to the proceeding, what other means will that other party to the proceeding have to get the information they need and in the action at hand?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, data requests remain the primary method of investigation in commission proceedings, but the commission rule remains that any party may ask the commission for leave to take any other method of discovery, so including depositions. So it seems to me that the commission, until it amends that rule, would still be operating under the assumption that any party may request leave to conduct a deposition.
I'm sorry, I'm going to keep you for one more question. And so if we change the statute, though, will your rules change?
Madam Chair, I couldn't say. That's a question for the commission, and the commission has not yet had an opportunity to deliver.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? All right, would the sponsor like to close?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. Just a quick note, if you look there on line 11, it's May, okay? So it's just removing a problem that can arise. The commission can still approve to take dispositions. It's just they have to be asked instead of forced. I don't think it's a big lift. It just streamlines the process. And I think as we're going forward, you're going to see with some of the situations that we're doing with that we need to be able to have models that are more effective, more efficient, and more streamlined to be able to address the needs that we find ourselves in, the shortfalls of energy, which the bill we just heard, and I think other things that we learned during ETIC and so on and so forth, that anything we can do that makes the process go smoother and quicker. We did choose this form. We've put those folks in place, so I feel that if it gives them a little better tools in their toolbox, that we should just move forward and simplify the process. And with that, I do ask for a due pass.
Thank you. This closes the hearing on House Bill 558. All right, committee, it looks like we have four bills on Wednesday, and so plan to, you know, bring your A game. We'll be here for a little while on Wednesday, and I don't know anything else from Chair Zolnikoff, and so if I hear anything, we'll get you guys messages and let you guys know. Thank you. Am I closing this out? Goodbye.
Goodbye. Toodaloo.